Hello, and thank you for joining us. I am Naval Davar, Associate Professor at the MD Anderson Cancer Center. Joining me today are Dr. Courtney DiNardo, Associate Professor at the Department of Leukemia, University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, and Dr. Eunice Wang, Chief of the Leukemia Service at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center. Welcome. So here are our disclosures. Okay, so I'm going to give a very brief introduction before I hand it over to Dr. DiNardo and then Dr. Wang to speak about the specifics of the updates and breakthroughs in newly diagnosed and relapsed AML. I think one important thing to note is that you're going to see discussed extensively throughout the talk is that molecular profiling and mutation analysis is really now critical to all treatment decisions in acute myeloid leukemia. This is true for younger AML, absolutely, but also now I think percolating into older AML population. We knew for a few years now that they had prognostic impact, as you can see here when you add the molecular data to the cytogenetics that we've used for many decades, we can see that there is further stratification of the outcomes, and we often use this information now for deciding transplant, non-transplant decisions, but also there are a number of targeted therapies, so it's no longer just prognostic, but also has predictive value. This is kind of showing you that when you use cytogenetics and at least the common molecular mutations for analysis, we're able to really understand the prognostic impact and expected outcomes for given patients with acute myeloid leukemia. What are the important targets that are currently in development or already developed or have drugs in the pipeline that we're excited about? I think the three big ones are FLT3, that's FLT3, ITD, as well as D835, for which there are approved agents that Dr. DiNardo and Wang will talk about. KIT mutations, which, you know, there was some interest, have never caught traction, but we sometimes do use KIT inhibitors in certain subsets of acute myeloid leukemia, but the big ones then are IDH as well as FLT3, and emerging, I think, of a lot of interest to many of us here are MLL, for which there are menin inhibitors now in early trials showing some very exciting data and hopefully updates coming later in 2020 and 2021, and then TP53-directed therapies such as APR246 and CD47 antibodies, magrolimab. So we really do have a lot of personalization of therapies. Of course, a lot of these are being developed as single agents, but the hope is that they will move forward in combinations that will lead to not just improvement in median survival, but hopefully long-term cure rates. So just to highlight the progress that has happened, you know, just looking at this even from 10,000 foot view, you can clearly see that there is a dramatic rate of progress happening in the last 2 to 3 years. As you know, 8 drugs have already been US FDA approved for the treatment of acute myeloid leukemia, including 4 targeted therapies, 2 FLT3 and 2 IDH inhibitors, as well as immune drugs such as gemtuzumab, very important major breakthrough venetoclax, and other novel drugs like glastegib and CPX. And in fact, there are also additional drugs that have shown phase 3 positive data, such as CC486, an oral agent that is the first drug to show improvement in a randomized phase 3 study in a maintenance in acute myeloid leukemia, and hopefully will be a 9th drug to be approved very soon. And then another major area of development is occurring in the immunotherapy world. There are a number of new antibody drug conjugates looking at other targets beyond CD33 for which gemtuzumab is approved, and also T-cell based strategies, which includes agents such as bispecific antibodies, as well as macrophage and T-cell activating drugs, which I think over the next few years we're going to see more and more data, and hopefully we'll find important roles in different combinations and subsets of AML. So with that, I am going to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Courtney DiNardo, to take over the frontline therapy. Courtney, please.
Perfect. Thank you so much. So just a, you know, 10-minute brief overview of some of the progress and challenges in our frontline therapy for AML. And 2 slides just to kind of remind everyone what we know. So we know that the average age at AML is in general older, right? Most patients are going to be in their 60s and older. And in the blue bars along the right, you can see that really by age, the expected survival unfortunately decreases pretty significantly by ongoing decades. And we also know that genomics is really important. You already saw the slide from Dr. Davar. This is another one from Dr. Haferlak showing that with standard intensive chemotherapy or APL-based therapy, there are certain subgroups who do really well, right? Those with double mutant CBP-alpha, core binding factor leukemias, NPM1 mutations. And then there are those patients along the bottom, those with complex cytogenetics or MLL rearrangements, MECOM rearrangements that do unfortunately really poorly. And so, you know, we've used that knowledge as well as an assessment of fitness, right, which I'm sure we'll spend a lot of time talking about in the case presentations, to really decide on, you know, our younger patients who are getting standard intensive curative therapy, and then our older patients who we are trying to improve quality of life and responses, although without oftentimes a very durable response in this population. This has kind of been our ongoing algorithm that we've used for decades now. And so, you know, as was mentioned, there are now several new therapies for our patients. And so, you know, we're not really deciding one of two different bins, but we're trying to now incorporate all these treatments into the best outcome for any specific patient walking in our door. So we have new targeted therapies, the FLT3 inhibitor, midostaurin, gilteritinib, the IDH inhibitors, small molecule therapies like venetoclax and glastegib, as well as monoclonal antibody gemtuzumab and the liposomal encapsulated dono and cytarabine. And so what I thought I would do, instead of going through all the data in each and every clinical trial, I will spend a few minutes on a few key trials that were recently presented, but here spend a bit of time taking you through kind of what is turning into kind of a potential diagnostic and treatment paradigm for our newly diagnosed AML patients. And so, you know, there's, we take, you know, in blue, our patients who are eligible for intensive chemotherapy, and it shows really how important genomic assessment is. So patients who are core binding factor, you know, in addition to intensive chemotherapy, we add gemtuzumab. In a patient with a FLT3 mutation, in addition to intensive chemotherapy, the incorporation of a FLT3 inhibitor. Right now, midostaurin is approved in that indication. Several other second-generation FLT3 inhibitors under evaluation for incorporation into this area. The fourth one in blue, those with therapy-related AML or AML with MDS-related changes, that's where Vyxeos or CPX351 is indicated specifically for that group. And then everyone else, you know, standard intensive chemotherapy, whether that's 7+3 or a FLAG-IDA or CLIA-based approach is currently recommended in many different clinical trials in that second level, looking at whether the incorporation of venetoclax or IDH inhibitors or gemtuzumab is going to assist in patients in that category. On the right are those patients ineligible for intensive chemotherapy, those that we have frequently often used azacitidine, decitabine, low-dose cytarabine alone. And here is where I'll show some data in the next slides where the hypomethylating agent with venetoclax has really shown a significant survival advantage in the VLEA data that I think is now becoming, at least in the United States, a very kind of updated standard of care regimen. But the incorporation of FLT3 inhibitors and IDH inhibitors is also appropriate and leads to many of the decisions. You know, when you have a patient, for instance, with an IDH inhibitor, do you give them with an IDH mutation an IDH inhibitor or hypomethylating agents with venetoclax? Because both are approved and both are very appropriate. And then, you know, in patients who are eligible and appropriate to move forward with a transplant, absolutely that's the indication, but more data now coming out about the importance finally of maintenance therapy, CC486. And I'll spend one slide kind of going through that study population. So we know all this information is important, yeah, but how do we actually do it? So in general, this is kind of expectations for our workup of AML in 2019-2020, where we, you know, often get the flow cytometry and morphology results within the same day. It takes about 2 days or so to have conventional cytogenetics rushed or fish, if we're lucky, for certain of the fusion or translocations, several days for mutational results. And many people will look at this slide and say, gosh, it takes me, you know, 2 weeks or 3 weeks to get my FLT3 or my IDH result. And so this is definitely something that's different in different institutions and different places throughout the world, but it is possible to get mutational testing within 3 to 5 days. And so I think that's definitely something we need to be kind of pushing and working with our hematopathology colleagues to make sure this is something that is available because it is important for our patients. One important abstract that was presented at ASH just this past year kind of asked that question that everyone is wondering. Well, you know, we know this genomic information is important. Can we wait for this information, though, before we start our therapy? And so this is a study which looked at over 2,000 patients who were receiving that standard intensive chemotherapy, 7+3, through the German registry. And they looked at all ages, and they found that the time from diagnosis to treatment didn't affect outcome in those patients who were intensively treated, looking at, you know, in terms of patient response or early mortality or survival. So I think this is reassuring, but you also have to take it with the knowledge that this is a retrospective review, which is as good as kind of the data that existed. And many patients with proliferative disease probably did not wait to start treatment, and treatment was started early. So it's just something to keep in mind that if you have a stable patient, absolutely, this gives us some kind of reassurance that waiting for this information is a safe thing to do. A slide or two on venetoclax and AML, because I think, you know, this is one of those kind of key new therapies that is going to be more and more relevant in AML, which is a BCL2 inhibitor. So it allows the binding and the initiation of apoptosis through inhibition of BCL2. And these are the two regimens that are approved now for our newly diagnosed older AML, just in a kind of in a picture type form, showing that there is a daily ramp up of the venetoclax along with ongoing therapy of either the hypomethylating agent or the low dose cytarabine, with the population that was eligible for the trial along the right, which is an age over 75 or poor performance status or underlying comorbidities. And these are two slides just going through the VLAA results. So this is the CR, CRI and CRCRH results with AZA and venetoclax, the large bar on the left and the azacitidine alone on the right, showing a significant improvement in the CR rate and in the composite CR-CRI and then CR-CRH rate, as well as a impressive early median time to early remissions in patients with the combination. And the overall survival shown here, improving from about 10 months with azacitidine alone to 15 months with the combination. So representing one of these kind of key trials showing a survival advantage in this older patient population. The last study I want to spend just one slide going over as some kind of baseline information, because it's a newer study that has been resulted at a recent meeting, is the QUASAR AML-001 study, which is the CC486 maintenance therapy, often called oral azacitidine. Although I think we need to be a little bit careful when we call it oral azacitidine. And I say that because the PK properties are different. So this is not something that is equivalent to the oral to the IV azacitidine dosage. It is a longer, kind of more tonic, if you will, administration. So the characteristics are different. And this oral azacitidine, or CC486 maintenance, was used in patients who were 55 years of age or older, who had completed intensive chemotherapy, were not going to transplant, and were enrolled within 90 days of their first CR or CRI. And they were randomized to either CC486 or placebo. And in these slides, you can see there was a essentially doubling of both the overall survival and the relapse-free survival. So kind of expectations around this would suggest to us that this will be a new approval coming soon that we'll have the ability to use in patients, you know, who are this population, right? Patients who are not eligible or not appropriate or have declined proceeding with transplant after their initial remission. And so that is a whirlwind tour of kind of the newly diagnosed landscape and two of the kind of important recent trial studies. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Dr. DiNardo. That was really focused and high-level overview, and I'm sure we're going to discuss a lot of the other nuances with IDH, FLT3, and how we select in the cases. And with that, I'll turn it over to Dr. Eunice Wang, my colleague from Roswell Park, to cover some of the new molecular immune therapies, especially in the relapse setting. Eunice?
Thank you very much. So I'm just in follow-up of Dr. DiNardo's point. We're moving on to treatment of patients who have relapse and refractory AML. And here is potentially where we're seeing a huge number of novel agents and approaches, which promises to lead to additional FDA approvals of drugs for this patient population over the next 6 to 12 months. So what is the outcomes of patients with relapse and refractory AML? Well, unfortunately, we have made some progress with the advent of targeted therapies, as we see here. IDH1, IDH2, and FLT3 inhibitors have shown response rates of anywhere from 30 to 40% in the relapse refractory population. However, you can see that the median overall survival for patients with relapse and refractory AML still remains fairly dismal. If you look on the left-hand side, you can see the outcomes of various both intensive and low, high-intensive and low-intensive chemotherapy regimens treatment for patients with refractory relapse disease. And you can see overall, none of these therapies in the chemotherapy arena alone is significantly superior to another. The targeted therapies we see on the right have made inroads. But again, you can see that overall, the median survival of these patients is anywhere from a few months to maybe a little bit more than a year. So this is the landscape in which we are looking at in terms of improvements for the care of our patients. As mentioned previously by both of my prior colleagues, molecular analyses, particularly mutational profiling, remains a key aspect of treatment of AML at any stage. It's important to recognize that leukemia is not a static disease, and although you may have performed extensive next-generation sequencing and mutational analysis at the time of diagnosis, at the time of recurrence of AML, there can be significant alterations in the clonal architecture, which constitutes the disease in the relapse-refractory setting. As you can see here, the clones at diagnosis may have differential sensitivities to the treatment modalities that are implemented in the frontline setting, leading to significant outgrowth of clones that may have dominant or absent mutations compared to what they see at diagnosis. Why is it important to perform this mutational analysis again at the time of disease recurrence? It is essential to do so because it will allow you to optimize your treatment selection. As you can see here in the relapse refractory setting, there are targeted agents available which can be equally or more effective for the treatment of relapse refractory AML than even high-dose intensive chemotherapy. So the presence of a FLT3 mutation or IDH mutation or expression of specific surface antigens may allow for the clinician or the practitioner to identify treatment options which could be of use, could be a potential more benefit to the patient than exposing them to additional inpatient salvage chemotherapy. In addition, when we compare the outcomes of chemotherapy, as mentioned previously, in many cases, there's no necessarily superiority to using an intensive induction or reinduction strategy over less aggressive regimens. So this must also be kept in mind given the circumstances and the age and the quality of life issues that we're facing in a patient with recurrent disease. Just to review briefly some of the molecularly targeted therapies, IDH1 inhibitors, ivosidenib and enasidenib are small molecule oral inhibitors of these mutant enzymes, which are present in anywhere from 5 to 15% of patients, both at diagnosis and subsequently at relapse. You can see here that utilization of one or the other of these small molecule targeted inhibitors can lead to overall response rates of up to 40%, with complete remission rates of 20%. Patients who achieve a CR or a CR with incomplete hematologic recovery can have median overall survival lasting up to 1 to 2 years at the median of 18 to 19 months, as you can see here. However, over time, no one is effectively cured of their disease, and there have been many mechanisms of resistance which have been identified, primarily the presence of or development or selection for additional AML clones possessing activating signaling mutations such as RAS or FLT3. And we'll just touch upon that a little bit later. FLT3 inhibitors are highly effective in the relapse refractory setting, particularly the use of second generation inhibitors such as gilteritinib, crenolinib, and quizartinib. Gilteritinib, shown here on the right hand side, has been shown in a randomized phase 3 trial, the ADMIRAL trial, to yield superior overall survival and complete remission rates as compared to both high intensity as well as low intensity therapy for first-line salvage therapy of patients with FLT3 mutant disease, either characterized by FLT3 ITD and or FLT3 TKD mutations. Quizartinib similarly was shown in a phase 3 trial to yield less impressive overall survival benefit, but still statistically significant improvement as opposed to either high or low dose chemotherapy in the same setting. And trials with quizartinib, gilteritinib, and crenolinib are proceeding in combination with various agents now in the frontline setting. What about patients failing venetoclax therapy? We have, as Courtney DiNardo mentioned, the venetoclax-based therapy is quickly becoming the new standard of care, at least for treatment of our older patients. And we can see here that despite the improvement in overall survival, patients are still relapsing and recurring after venetoclax-based therapy. Repeat genomic analysis at the time of disease recurrence again identifies the presence of FLT3 and RAS mutations as predictors of poor response and recurrent disease. We also see, again, the same poor characteristics that are associated with poor overall outcome in the frontline setting, specifically the presence of TP53 or adverse cytogenetics and complex cytogenetics being issues with upfront venetoclax therapy. For this reason, there has been a great deal of interest in combining our targeted therapies. If patients are developing or are prone to develop FLT3 mutation as a result of prolonged venetoclax administration, potentially the combination of a FLT3 inhibitor and a BCL2 inhibitor can be a useful approach. And here is some early data from a phase 1b study showing that the application of BCL2 inhibition in combination with gilteritinib can lead to very, very high response rates, particularly in patients that have had prior FLT3 exposure. In terms of inhibitors of other pathways, there have been a great deal of interest in focusing studies and developing agents that are targeting other arms of the apoptosis pathway to particularly overcome resistance mechanisms which develop in the context of venetoclax pretreatment. So you can see here that venetoclax is a key player in the apoptosis pathway and preventing cell death in patients who are treated with chemotherapy and other agents. You can see here, as Dr. Dalver mentioned, APR246 is a small molecule activator of a mutant P53 pathway, which has been very promising and showed high levels of responses for the treatment of patients with TP53 mutant disease. For patients who have P53 wild type disease at the time of relapse, isonutlin is a MDM2 inhibitor which reactivates wild type P53 and promotes degradation of apoptotic pathways and has shown promising activity for the treatment of P53 wild type. This is the schema of the MIROS phase 3 randomized control study examining whether this MDM2 inhibitor in combination with intermediate dose cytarabine can improve response rates and overall survival as compared to cytarabine alone in fit patients who are eligible for a higher intensity regimen at the time of disease recurrence. I'd like to just close in the last couple of minutes with the mention of immunotherapeutics. Immunotherapy has been highly successful for treatment of several solid tumors, but has yet to make a significant impact, although that is probably going to change, for the treatment of patients with AML. Numerous surface antigens expressed in AML blasts have been identified as potential targets of immunotherapeutic approaches. In addition to CD33, which is obviously an active target given the use of gemtuzumab, there are two new target antigens for which antibodies have been developed, which show enormous amounts of progress and promise for treatment of relapsing refractory AML. This is the first agent, magrolimab, which is an anti-CD47 antibody. CD47 is expressed by cancer cells as a means of evading macrophage-activated phagocytosis. Inhibition of the CD47 pathway with this antibody has, in combination with azacitidine, resulted in remarkable responses, particularly in patients with poor prognosis AML, which otherwise does not respond to conventional chemotherapy. As you can see here in a small and gradually enlarging phase 1b study, in the frontline setting, patients with AML have almost a two-third response to the combination of magrolimab and azacitidine, and in particular, patients with P53 mutant disease tend to demonstrate very high responses and durability of response with magrolimab therapy. Another antibody, anti-CD70 antibody, cusatuzumab, has been proposed as a way to target pathways important for the survival and proliferation of leukemic stem cells. Early phase 1 study of 12 patients with newly diagnosed AML demonstrated, again, very high response rates of over two-thirds of patients having achieved a complete remission with the utilization of this antibody, again, in combination with azacitidine. We also have seen the development of antibody-drug conjugates targeting CD33 as well as CD123. Here is an example of a CD123 antibody-drug conjugate, which is being developed not only for relapsed refractory AML, but also other malignancies. To conclude, there also has been a great deal of activity in the T-cell directed therapy space for relapsed refractory AML, bispecific antibodies, which lead to activation of the immune system, as well as dual targeting of AML cells, as well as CAR T-cell therapies, have been developed. AMG-330 is an example of a CD33-CD3 bispecific antibody, which has led at higher doses to 20-25% response rates in patients with multiply relapsed AML. And CAR T-cell therapy is really in its infancy, and we're seeing development of both autologous as well as allogeneic CAR T-cell approaches. So with that, I'll turn the program back to Dr. Dauber to discuss further cases. Thank you very much.
All right, great. Thank you very much, Dr. Wang and Dr. DiNardo. So we have three cases, and you know, we're going to kind of, I'll go through the case, and then I'll open up, and then we can just have open discussion, bring up any points you think are important or any thoughts that you have. And of course, we'll try to make these three cases a little bit different so we can cover different aspects of the disease. So first one is a 55-year-old man diagnosed with FLT3-ITD AML, allelic ratio 0.45, diploid cytogenetics, receives standard induction 7+3 with the addition of the FLT3 TKI midostaurin, and then gets consolidation HIDAC midostaurin, and then gets maintenance with midostaurin. So obviously, you know, this is a patient we would be considering for transplant. He has a high allelic ratio of FLT3-ITD mutation. However, as we all know in our practice, even at large academic centers, there's a large number of patients we cannot get to transplant. Either the patients, after listening to all the side effects, don't want to do it, or for some reason there's logistical barriers, finances, distance from center. And I'd say we're still seeing about 30-40% of our patients that we want to transplant eventually do not make it to transplant. And so this patient said he did not want transplant. So we said, okay, we complete the maintenance, we're going to monitor you and hope for the best. Unfortunately, as we often see in these high-risk mutational subgroups, he did relapse 6 months later, new onset pancytopenia, bone marrow was done, confirmed relapse AML, and his performance status is pretty good at this time, and he's here in clinic now. He does have a matched sibling donor available, so the question is going to be, what is the next course of action for this patient? And this case was actually provided to me by Dr. Wang, so I'm going to start the discussion with Dr. Wang and see what her thoughts were. And I guess the first question would be, when this patient is here in front of you now, is there additional information you would need, and what information that would be, and how would you use that to decide the treatment?
So thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to provide some feedback on this. So the first piece of information, which should always be the first thing that one asks in this setting after determining the patient has relapse, is to ask yourself, what is the genomics of the relapse? In particular, this individual has had, at this point, probably at least 18 months or more of FLT3 inhibitor therapy with midostaurin. Now, midostaurin is a pretty broad spectrum tyrosine kinase inhibitor that also inhibits FLT3 wild type and mutant. But the question is, with that treatment selection and with prolonged midostaurin use, is the disease that is recurring at this time still FLT3 mutant? Or is it actually, as we're seeing very commonly in these pretreated individuals, actually recurrence with FLT3 wild type disease? So what I would like to do is to repeat the genomic analyses to determine if the patient has FLT3, and also to see whether there are other mutations and or any surface antigens expressed by flow cytometric, which could be targets for approaches that could have greater efficacy than just broad spectrum chemotherapy in this setting.
So yeah, so maybe I'll ask Dr. DiNardo. So for this patient, you know, what would be the molecular mutation profiling you would request, and how quickly do you get that? I think that's a big question, right, in the community. Is there a way to stratify and get the mutations you want earlier? How can that be done? And which are the key ones in, let's say, both frontline as well as then in relapse that you really want before you embark on any kind of treatment?
Yeah, I mean, in this case, the number one mutation that you want is the FLT3 ITD, right? You want to see if that ITD is still present at relapse, because there is a small but real, maybe 20 to 30% population of patients that are not going to have that FLT3 ITD at relapse when they've had this degree of FLT3 inhibitor therapy with midostaurin. You know, there are other genomic mutations that are really helpful. Like NPM1 commonly co-occurs with FLT3 ITD and lends itself to a more favorable prognosis. Whether that's more or less relevant at this point in the relapse setting, you know, you could make a case where I think the knowledge of whether there's an IDH1 or an IDH2 mutation that's co-occurring in this patient is useful information. And that happens about a third of the time. Also, there will be a FLT3 ITD and an IDH mutation. In terms of how long it takes to get that information, here we're fortunate that we can rush certain mutations within about 3 to 5 days. So FLT3 ITD being one of them. Doing single genes take about that 5 week time point. Most places when they send out will have decided to kind of batch multiple different genes together into some sort of MDS AML panel, which, you know, has anywhere from 20 to 100 different genes, all of which are kind of relevant in a population of MDS AML. And so the challenge is when you're at a center that does that send out test, that, you know, that can often take, you know, 2 to 3 weeks or so. So you really need to have an ability in this case to have a FLT3 ITD done quickly. And the other thing I didn't say that I think is important is the FLT3 D835 mutation is also really important, because when we're talking about different FLT3 inhibitors, if this patient does have a recurrent disease with an ITD, there are available FLT3 inhibitors like gilteritinib that will hit both the ITD and the D835, and other ones in development like quizartinib, which is approved kind of outside of the US, that doesn't hit the D835 well. So that knowledge is also important in choosing the FLT3 strategy.
I think you make a very important point. I mean, you know, the RATIFY study, I think they did a subset of about 48 patients who relapsed and looked at the molecular sequencing, and they showed a very high number, higher than most others have shown. Almost 40% had no detectable FLT3. I mean, we've done, and others have done analyses and published, somewhere in the range of 20 to 25% will have no FLT3. But the point is, it's a good number, so you cannot reach for gilteritinib right away, I would say, if that was the choice, because you may not be treating a FLT3. So I think that's clinically very important. But let's say in the next thing, let's say he does come back and he is FLT3 ITD, still at a high allelic ratio, 0.5 or so in that range, without a D835. So what would you select for this patient? He's about a year plus from the induction plus midostaurin. And, you know, you have the option, of course, of gilteritinib, but potentially maybe an option of reinduction. So what would you think of for this patient, Eunice?
So, I mean, I think you can argue that to use potentially a repeat high dose or intermediate dose cytarabine-based salvage regimen, given the fact that he's as a young gentleman with excellent performance status and is asymptomatic, the feeling being that you could quickly get him into a complete remission and then potentially transition him to a potentially curative allogeneic stem cell transplantation. However, there's a certain percentage of individuals, even those with younger individuals, don't tolerate repeat induction chemotherapy well. And you would run the risk of, when you do that, particularly if you include an anthracycline, that you could have morbidities that occur with, like, the, for example, cardiac toxicity, a decreased EF, performance status issues that might actually delay his time to go to a transplant. So I think ideally, and we would want to potentially maybe offer a salvage regimen, potentially with additional FLT3 inhibitor. If that is something that you think is going to be poorly tolerated, I think a gilteritinib-based regimen, potentially gilteritinib alone, or possibly gilteritinib with a low-dose azacitidine. We certainly would want to get him into a CR to allow him to proceed to subsequent transplant. So I think that a high-dose salvage regimen would be reasonable, but I think given the ADMIRAL results, potentially gilteritinib offers a less toxic way to get somebody to that transplant, despite the without the risk of additional comorbidities. I'd be interested in see what Dr. DiNardo thinks.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, oftentimes when patients relapse with a FLT3 ITD, they'll be very proliferative, right? And so, you know, I think one of the really interesting things about the ADMIRAL study is that, you know, FLAG-IDA and intensive chemotherapy salvages were one of the options that the patient could be randomized to. What we see is that gilteritinib does better than the standard induction therapies that don't include a FLT3 inhibitor, of course. And so just, you know, that a simple outpatient daily pill will do better than a reinduction intensive strategy that doesn't incorporate a FLT3 inhibitor. But I think that there is definitely room for improvement on gilteritinib alone in the salvage setting, because, you know, we know that remissions don't last that long, that resistance pathways are common through other mechanisms, RAS pathway, BCR-ABL at relapse, which is kind of something that we hadn't seen before. And so I know Dr. Daver has started putting together some of our experience of, you know, gilteritinib with cytarabine, with azacitidine, and I think, you know, I think there will be more and more data coming out of relapsed strategies incorporating gilteritinib. You mentioned the venetoclax gilteritinib data as well, kind of putting combinations together to improve even further on the ability to get patients back into a second remission and a deeper remission to get them to a transplant.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's really important. I think gilteritinib absolutely is major breakthrough, but, you know, when you look at the long-term follow-up, even though the response rates were 54% marrow remission CRc as compared to 26%, and the CRh rates were doubled, the median survival is about 9.3 versus 5.6 months, and at 1.5, 2 years, of course, we're still getting to 15-20%. So I think all of us are very excited and working on these trials, combining it. You know, the ven-gilteritinib will be updated. That is looking very promising. But even moving beyond that, you know, are there potentials to combine azaven, which of course now frontline is being used heavily, with potentially drugs like gilteritinib, quizartinib? So I think it's going to be very exciting. And in the future, I feel that and we're already seeing this in some of our centers, some of these patients who 5 years ago, you know, we were in a very, very bad situation. Now we're able to get many of these into deep remissions and to transplant with combinations of the second generation FLT3 inhibitor. So I agree. I would probably go for a gilteritinib plus approach, whether it's with AZA or AZA-VEN. Of course, there's myelosuppression. You have to balance that and, you know, use growth factors as needed. But I think this patient can have a potentially long-term remission. And I guess the other point would be also a good patient to do post-transplant maintenance, right? If he got to maintenance, then, you know, using a FLT3 inhibitor, maybe sorafenib or gilteritinib if it gets approved. So I think let's move on to the other case. This is one that probably will have more discussion on it. So this is a 62-year-old male with overall weakness, fatigue, dyspnea, and exertion, who presents for routine checkup, was found to have a white count of 15, hemoglobin is low, platelets are low, and is diagnosed with AML with MDS-related changes. And the local doctor was initially thinking 7+3 induction, was referred to us and comes with, as you can see, mainly tachycardia, but otherwise those are relatively stable. White count is going up now, a little bit higher, 50,000, and continues to have cytopenia. So, of course, the first steps in the management of this patient are admitting him, giving him hydrea, IV fluids, allopurinol, PICC line, chest x-ray, echocardiogram. This is what we do on a day-to-day basis. I was actually rounding today morning. We had two new AMLs. This is the usual thing. You want everything quickly, bone marrow same day, get the echo, get the x-ray, get the PICC in, and hopefully then we can proceed. Important is, of course, to get the cytogenetic. You never want to miss. Core binding factor, APL. You know, APL is, I hear from community doctors a lot of time about how they think this is APL or not. I will tell you, with our experience, we see thousands of patients. I cannot tell you for sure if a patient has APL or no. Yes, there may be more suggestive, less suggestive, but we're always surprised. So I say, when in doubt, you know, start them on something like ATRA and then check quickly for the POT test or the FISH. So these were done, and this patient, I think it's important to look at the background history here, because we're kind of getting in that 60 plus age. So the patient has a history of coronary artery disease, hypertension. As you can see, he has good family support. He's an anesthesiologist, physician himself. So we're going to expect, hopefully, good compliance and follow-up and no significant family history. So this is kind of the scenario. Overall, reasonably healthy, good performance status. And then you get the bone marrow, let's say in 48 hours, you see that he has acute myeloid leukemia, 70% blast. And diploid cytogenetics. So I guess at this point, and then you have molecular data as well, we usually get this in about 4 days, at least the top level key molecular mutational data. And as you can see, this person has certain mutations. The one of interest, of course, is going to be the IDH1 mutation potentially in this 62-year-old patient. So I guess the question would be, now you have this 62-year-old patient with IDH1 mutation along with some other mutations, some cardiovascular history 3 years ago, and what would be your treatment approach for this patient? So, Dr. DiNardo, you want to discuss it?
So, I mean, this is a perfect case of someone who's kind of almost in that borderline gray population, right? So in general, I think most people would agree that those over the age of about 70, we think about lower intensity therapies, and those younger than 60, just somewhat arbitrarily chosen, we're really focusing on intensive chemotherapy unless there's something really significant about their medical history that makes us concerned about, you know, using cytarabine and anthracycline. But in that 60 to 70 range, I think we're starting to see, you know, that because we have reasonable outcomes with our new lower intensity strategies, right? Venetoclax combinations, we're seeing remission rates kind of as high as you would with higher intensity strategies, and the ability to transition a patient to transplant with both modalities of therapy. I think that the conversation is changing. That being said, you know, this is a 62-year-old gentleman who is healthy as best we can see. I see that hypertension and some underlying heart disease, the echocardiogram, you know, any underlying EF, which I didn't see, is going to be really important to decide, am I okay with an anthracycline? But barring any kind of structural or concerning heart disease, I think, you know, in a 62-year-old with proliferative disease, a white count that's gone from 15 to 52 within this, you know, amount of time in this first case, without any particularly high-risk cytogenetic or genomic features, this is someone that I would still prioritize an intensive chemotherapy regimen for.
Yeah. Eunice, what are your thoughts?
I would agree. I mean, I think this gentleman, the data suggests that in somebody that's fit enough for chemotherapy, in this individual, I don't see anything specifically that would preclude. He's a diploid, he's an intermediate karyotype. IDH1 can predict, particularly in combination with NPM1, for good results with the cytarabine-based approach. So I agree. I think I would agree with an aggressive induction, cytarabine, donidalorsen approach. I guess my question is, and again, I would throw it back to my colleagues, is this somebody that you, because they have an intermediate karyotype, would you add gemtuzumab to the 7+3 to try to prolong event-free survival? And is this a patient with this profile that you would be thinking about maybe not doing transplant in? So I'd just throw that back. Would this patient be a candidate for transplant? Would you want a transplant? And if you're not going to transplant, would you add something to 7+3 to improve their outcomes, to preclude them having to go to transplant or having relapse?
Yeah, I think those are great points. I mean, I think, you know, gemtuzumab, we obviously don't talk about too much outside of the core binding factor setting, where, of course, its efficacy is outstanding. And you know, I think most groups, and we for sure are always adding it. But there is data, as you said, even in the intermediate or diploid group, showing a 7% or so survival benefit, of course, based on a meta-analysis that was done across 3,000 patients, which is quite similar, actually, to what mitostorin shows, right, if you kind of look at it that way.
Yes, about a 7% four-year benefit, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, I think it's a very reasonable option, you know, if we cannot add a targeted therapy to consider addition of gemtuzumab to this patient. I think the transplant question is, that's kind of part two of the case, and we'll get to that, because I think it is tough in these patients, right? I mean, historically we've pushed, and still, at least in our experience, we're getting about 50-60% of them to transplant. Even the biggest transplant centers, usually you cannot get more than that. There's a lot of hurdles that come in. So then what do you do, for example, if either you decide or the patient decides, you know, we cannot go for transplant? So with that, let me move on to the second part for this patient. And as Dr. Wang was saying, you know, the considerations would be, one is to add gemtuzumab, but also there is some early data that Ethan Stein and Courtney have presented looking at adding IDH inhibitors to induction, and which at least in the one and a half year follow-up looked promising. So I guess not a standard yet, but will be interesting to see the kind of follow-up on that. So this patient was treated at our center, and we have a frontline trial, which is adding 2+3+7, a purine analog. You know, there's a lot of debate about this. Some of the European data seems to show improvement, the Polish data specifically, and the MRC for fludarabine. And I think to some extent this debate will get less and less as we start incorporating targeted therapies, venetoclax, FLT3, frontline. But he was treated at our center, and this was the trial ongoing at that time. So he got this induction, frontline patient, and the plan was to eventually consider to get him to transplant. He was admitted for the induction, as we do for most of our older patients, monitored closely. And he did have a pretty rough induction course. So he had major sepsis, pseudomonas, went to the ICU. You know, we're seeing this less and less with close monitoring and prophylactic antibiotics, but we still see it. I would say in about 5-8% of our patients, they are having major infection or sepsis. He was in the ICU for a while, eventually got better. And then the bone marrow that was done on day 28 confirmed that he is in remission with low-level flow cytometry still positive and still detectable mutations on the NGS panel. So I guess here now the question is, you know, and I kind of made this complicated case, but it's real case, is that the person had a very difficult induction, right? So going to Dr. Wang's point of, are you going to go for transplant in this person, because he's now showing you maybe transplant is going to be tough. So I guess the question here at this point would be, you know, what would be the next steps for this person? Would you continue with consolidation? Would you move him to lower intensity therapy now, HMA or HMA venetoclax, or would you move him to some form of maintenance? And if you did do consolidation, what would you consider for this patient? So maybe Courtney, you want to start?
So this is kind of one of those great questions where there's all sorts of different answers, and I can't actually remember what we ended up doing. So I'm excited to remind myself. So, I mean, I think in this patient, we can't go to transplant right away, right? He's been so beat up with his first month of therapy that you know is maybe a potential future goal, but that can't be the strategy right now. And for the same reason, I think kind of additional cycles of high dose therapy consolidation is probably not in his best interest. He's in a remission. We want to keep him in a remission, but we don't want to beat him up further with consolidation or a transplant. So I think, you know, we can probably all agree with that. And then the question is, well, what do we do for his maintenance therapy? therapy. He has an IDH1 mutation. Can we put him on ivosidenib alone? If he's particularly kind of myelosuppressed or, you know, having issues with ongoing infections, pseudomonal abscesses, that's definitely something we could consider. We could consider azacitidine and venetoclax maintenance in someone with a IDH1 mutation who's going to be very sensitive to venetoclax-based therapies. He would also be a perfect candidate for CC486, right? He would be exactly that patient population for someone who's, you know, an older adult who got intensive chemotherapy that for whatever reason can't get more consolidation or a transplant. So I think any of those options or, you know, a clinical trial of any of those or combinations would be a very important strategy to try to kind of keep him in a remission that will kind of improve with time.
Yeah. And Eunice, I was going to ask, I mean, you know, I think the little bit of the struggle that's going to happen in the community is when, let's say you want to go to CC4, I think this is a great candidate for CC486, right? I think transplant is going to be tough even a few months from now. When would you go for it? Would we push for a few more consolidations? Would you think, you know, we should go for it earlier? What's kind of going to be your approach or what's been your approach with the CC486 in the trials?
So I agree with Courtney. I think that this individual is not really a candidate for high-dose consolidation. And although, you know, it is appealing to think about using HMA venetoclax for this patient given the IDH mutation, we really don't have any data. The data we have with HMA venetoclax is in the upfront setting, and that particular combination, although highly effective for IDH mutant, is associated with significant amount of myelosuppression, prolonged with risks of mortality due to sepsis and pneumonia. And in somebody that had this particular history, I would be hesitant to have additional myelosuppression for a prolonged period of time. So my feeling would be to do the CC486 when and if it is available. It also it's an oral pill. The patient could be outpatient. You wouldn't have as severe the myelosuppression that you would see with the venetoclax HMA therapy. And I would see how the patient does. If the patient, I would argue that, and this is, as you mentioned, a physician, that if the patient is able to improve, participate in rehabilitation, physical therapy, if he had a fully matched donor, a sibling donor, I think the goal that I would have would be to try to, over the next 3 or 6 months, see whether he could regain enough performance status to be eligible for a transplant. Because although CC46 did double the overall event-free survival for patients in the QUASAR study, the curves all trend downwards. So what you saw was you saw delaying of the time or a prolonging of the time until they had disease recurrence and had events. But the curve certainly did not plateau, and we certainly did not cure anybody. And I think for somebody that's in this age group, if they're looking for a curative approach, I would still be looking to transition them to that transplant for the best long-term outcome.
Yep, so great. So let's go, because I think this is kind of where, you know, you're going to see there are different approaches and different things that are going to happen. Even among the physicians, there's not going to be a consensus. So he kind of did recover. We gave him very reduced consolidation. We cut the doses by 50%. And of course, transplant, there was discussion. He got a little bit better. You know, we were on the fence. He was on the fence about whether to do it or not. And eventually, you know, after a lot of discussion, as we see among our patients, you know, a lot of times we send them to transplant. They come back 3 weeks later and say, yeah, I talked to them. I'm not going to do it. That's it. I mean, this is not uncommon. So we then did put him on CC486 maintenance after he had gotten the consolidation. And then he's continued it now for a while and is ongoing. So he was one of the patients on the trials. I think it's going to be very interesting to see the data of the CC486 once it's published, the details, because I guess one of the big questions I have is, you know, what is the impact of more consolidation versus less consolidation? You know what I'm saying? Yeah, because what we don't want is if, let's say, you know, you don't get consolidation and the data isn't as robust, we don't want in the community the rapid shift to I gave induction and then CC486. On the other hand, if it is, then maybe it's reasonable, but I personally have not, you know, seen that detailed data analysis, but you know, we will have to see. And then of course he has IDH, so there are going to be all these other questions coming up in the future for trials, hopefully, as to can you combine CC486 with the targeted therapies, and you know, how would that do in the future.
I had a question with that case. Yeah. So what happened with his MRD status during when he got the consolidations? Did he turn MRD negative by the time
yes.
you put him on CC46? So he was technically MRD negative. Because I think that's also, you know, when you're talking about the efficacy of the number of consolidations, you know, if he didn't get consolidation, he was still MRD positive, and you put him on CC46, would that have made a difference in terms of his long-term outcome? But you having given him 4 consolidations made him negative, and that in conjunction with the CC46 may be partially demonstrating his sensitivity to that therapy.
Yeah, I think that's exactly. So, I mean, you know, they did have this subset of patients who converted, who had like a low-level blast, which was 5 to 15%, and I forget, I think it was like 24% or so, converted to negative. So there may be some activity, but the bulk of the study was, as far as we know, in people who are in remission. MRD, we don't know. But I agree. I think I would be more comfortable, which is what we did, to get him MRD negative and then use this as a true maintenance, as opposed to in the active disease setting. I don't know if I would be as comfortable doing it. So yeah, absolutely. Okay, so we have just a few minutes left, but let's go to what I think is now becoming a very interesting and exciting area of therapy compared to a few years ago, where these were really, really bad or difficult patients for us to deal with. So a 74-year-old comes in with some bronchitis symptoms. He's got some prior history, including smoking, osteoarthritis, his diabetes type 2 controlled, and a PS of borderline, let's say close to 2. Pancytopenia, no circulating blast, and he is interested in therapies that can, you know, improve his survival to the best possibility. And bone marrow's done, 45% blast. He's got some MDS-related changes, deletion 5 and 7, and RUNX1 SRSF2 mutation. So the questions would be, what are the treatment options for this patient? So Eunice, what do you think? How would you approach this patient, 74-year-old, with these comorbidities in PS in today's practice?
So, I mean, I think that looking at this individual, I think the things that stand out to me really is his age, 74 years old, but not just that, but also his comorbidities. He's a smoker. He has a performance status isn't great. He has significant diabetes. He has, you know, some hypertension, controlled diabetes and hypertension. He has a performance status of 2. All of that makes me think that he is, and that in conjunction with his age of 74 years old, that he's not really a candidate for an aggressive approach, a cytarabine or anthracycline-based approach. It really would be more appropriate for a lower intensive therapy. We can see here that he doesn't have evidence of a FLT3 or an IDH1 IDHT mutation. So he does have mutations, but nothing that's specifically targetable at this point. I think the spliceosome inhibitors are still in very early development, and he does have, looks like, a prior MDS by biology and by histology, as well as by karyotype with the deletion 5q and deletion 7q abnormalities. So he is not going to be a candidate that is going to respond very well to an intensive approach or a cytarabine-based approach. So I would fall back upon the new standard of care, which really would be venetoclax plus NHMA. And he has not had prior HMA therapy since he's never been diagnosed. So I think he would be a candidate for that. And that would be associated with the best overall survival benefit for him at this point.
And Courtney, any thoughts or differences? And specific to this patient, you know, you've led the VLA studies, deletion 5, 7. What's been the response rate and outcome for these patients?
Yeah, I mean, this case is, you know, another one that you could choose anything in terms of treatment, right? He's CD33 positive, so you could use a gemtuzumab based therapy. Although with the deletion 5q and 7q, you know, adverse risk cytogenetics, I think that is really kind of on the lower list of my, you know, potential treatment options. Vyxeos, you know, is a approved therapy for someone with MDS related changes and these kind of MDS phenotype. But I agree with Dr. Wang. I think, you know, a 74-year-old gentleman with kind of this degree of underlying medical problems, even if they are controlled, is someone that I would opt for kind of the azacitidine and venetoclax. And so what we know, you know, is across the board, regardless of the genomics, response rates are high. With complex cytogenetics or deletion 7, you know, the response rate is more along the lines of 60% as opposed to like the, you know, 75% or more with IDH mutations or NPM1 mutations. I think it's actually like maybe 55 to 60% for this specific patient characteristics. So the majority will still respond, but as you were alluding to, the responses are not as durable in patients with these high-risk genomic features. So this, you know, I saw the question on the next slide. Is someone that you could consider a transplant for? I think, you know, in this gentleman who has this degree of kind of comorbidities, a lifelong smoker, bronchitis, you know, he's 74, it's going to be a challenge for sure. But I think it is something to definitely think about in our patients getting kind of venetoclax combinations or lower intensity combinations. If we are able to obtain a nice remission in people with high risk genomic features, you know, their duration of remission is relatively short. So a transplant should be something I think we now start thinking more and more about.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, you know, there's a lot of, and I think this is where quote unquote label and real world practice is going to differentiate. You know, myeloma guys have been dealing with this for years and years whenever you talk to them. And I think in leukemia, if you looked at quote unquote label, you could say, yeah, HMA-VEN could fall with this, CPX. He's a year younger, but he's close to the low-dose RSC-glastegib kind of label induction. So I think that's where kind of the selection art, and I totally agree, I would probably not give this person any form of intensive, whether it's traditional 3+7 or CPX-based. I think he's going to have a high induction mortality. So HMA-VEN, and then if he looks better, you know, improves his performance status, once he's in remission 3-4 months down the line, we may see that, then one could consider the transplant. I mean, also this is going to be a nice area to see where some of the novel therapies that are emerging, you know, APR, CD47, cusatuzumab, maybe added to the backbone of HMA-VEN, we're all excited could potentially be breakthroughs, and I think would be a very nice person to go on frontline clinical trials down the line. So with that, we are at the top of the hour, and I would like to thank Dr. DiNardo and Dr. Wang very, very much for the discussion. We didn't have much time, but I think we have actually kept a schedule, which I almost never do, so that's really good. I'm happy. And I would like to thank you all for joining and listening. And I think, you know, the key take-home message is, as we discussed, I think we still are very, very much interested in clinical trials. The breakthroughs are all the beginning. None of them are getting us close to 70 to 80% cure rates. So please still consider trials for all your patients. I hope in 10 years we will get to that 70, 80% cure rate for all patients. But today we're just starting the progress. Thank you all for joining us today. And we hope that this discussion was informative and helpful for the practice. And thank you again, Dr. Wang and Dr. DiNardo. Bye-bye.
Take care. Thanks.
Take care. Bye. Thank you so much.